Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, pastor of Denver Bible Church. Welcome to Real Science Radio. Jerry Bergman is a creationist author with degrees, including PhDs, from the University of Toledo, Bowling Green, and Wayne State University. He has authored hundreds of publications, some translated into a dozen languages, and many books, including his latest, which we hope to do a show on soon, Hitler and the Nazi Darwinian Worldview. Although today's interview is about whale evolution, from his peer-reviewed paper published in the latest edition of the CRSQ Journal, Dr. Bergman, welcome back to Real Science Radio.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, do you think soon we can do another interview on your book about the Nazi eugenic crusade?
I hope so, because so far that's one of the most successful books I've written.
Well, that sounds great. My producers read it, loved it, and I'm getting into it and love it. So let's plan on that. But first, you have a great article in the Creation Research Society Quarterly that I've gone through very carefully on whale evolution. So, Dr. Bergman, could we begin where you began? There are a couple different kinds of whales, right?
Right. Two main types of whales, the baleen whale and the other whale, which takes food in through its mouth in a very different way than the baleen whale does.
Yeah.
The tooth whale. I call them tooth whales.
The tooth whales. And there's quite a few different species of these kinds of whales. And what's interesting is that the evolutionists have addressed this from the days of Charles Darwin. You have a quote from Charles Darwin, and I'd love to read it to get us started. Darwin wrote this: "I can see no difficulty in a race of bears being rendered by natural selection more and more aquatic in their structure and habits, with larger and larger mouths, till a creature was produced as monstrous as a whale." That is quite a bit of storytelling, and you trace it till today, and the storytelling has remained pretty much the same at that level of sophistication.
Right, although it's no longer accepted that whales evolved from bears. The idea now is that, well, they've had many, many ideas. A cow-like animal's one, a hippopotamus-like animal's another, a hyena-like animal's another, wolf-like animal's another, and the latest idea is basically an animal that looks very, very much like a dog.
And so it seems, as I go through your history of how evolutionists have said that whales evolve, it seems that if there's such flexibility in their storytelling, if anatomy doesn't really work, then look at DNA. And if DNA doesn't quite tell a workable story, then look at the fossils again. And if that doesn't work, then look at some proteins, and maybe some proteins combined with some teeth. And so they're so flexible on what they might choose to claim that they have evidence that whales evolved, it's very hard to refute it because it's a moving target.
Oh, that's very true. And you have to realize the first thing is that they have evolutionary glasses on, and they see the world through those glasses. Hmm. And therefore, they know it's true. It has to be true. So therefore, all we have to do is figure out how whales evolved. And whales have been a major problem in evolution because they're so unlike any other animal. They're mammals. They feed their young with mammary glands like mammals do, etc. Mm. How do you explain where they came from? And yet they've been classified as fish until the 1600s.
The father of modern taxonomy himself, Carl Linnaeus, was, of course, a creationist. And you write he had to change his original classification of whales when he realized that they were mammals. And as a result, that really gave the Darwinists the challenge because they have to describe how a creature had evolved that was a fish-like creature. Then it evolved out of the ocean onto land, and then it had to re-evolve back into the ocean and readapt aquatic features. And so that's quite a tale.
Yes, it is. But ironically, I went to a scientific convention a few years ago, and one of the paleoanthropologists there was asked to delineate the fossil evidence that was greatest in the fossil record. And he chose whales, which surprised me. I just got a copy of the New Miller and Levine Biology Foundation Edition, which is a leading biology textbook in the United States. And on page 394, 395, guess what is the only example of fossil evidence for evolution they show? Whale evolution. And the second animal they show, Pachycetus, it looks very much like a dog.
So the second one looks like a dog. I imagine they present Rodicetus. Is that true?
Oh, yeah, he's there. Yeah, he's the fourth level in their hierarchy.
Now, I have a quote. You cover this in your article, but I have the quote from Dr. Philip Gingrich. He is the discoverer of Rodicetus. And he was being interviewed by Dr. Carl Werner, who you're very well aware of. He's a dear friend of Real Science Radio also. Dr. Gingrich admits, this is what he says on video, I speculated that it might have had a fluke tail. That's a whale-like tail. I now doubt that Rodicetus would have had a fluke tail. And then he goes on to say, since we discovered it, we have found the forelimbs, the hands, and the front arms of Rodicetus, and we understand that it doesn't have the kind of arms that could spread out like flippers on a whale. So he drew this thing, when they found just a few bones, to look like a whale with front flippers and a fluke tail. Then they found a lot more of the skeleton, and he says, you know what? It didn't have a fluke tail. It didn't have flippers. It had arms and legs and all and hands. So when he found it, they said, this evolved into a whale. Now they find out they were completely wrong on how they drew it, yet they kept it in its place as evolving into a whale.
That's true. And in the Miller book that I just quoted from, the current edition, which is 2012, they show, again, this creature doesn't have a fluke like a whale, and it looks kind of like a turtle, a blend between a turtle and a crocodile, I guess, is the best description.
So,
there he is.
And so, Dr. Bergman, when they find something new, of course, they have holes in their story they want to plug up. So they say, here it is. Here is the creature that obviously evolved into a whale because of its tail, its flippers, and so on, which is a silly kind of storytelling anyway. But then when they find out that it didn't swim in the ocean with a fluke tail and flippers, it was a land-dwelling creature. It's a completely different kind of creature than they had thought, which caused them to put it in the whale lineage, and yet it's like it's too big to fail. They can't admit it was a mistake because it became so popular, so it's just there, except with its arms and legs and so on.
That's a good point.
Can we talk about the difficulty in what the evolutionists perceive as what had happened? A land animal evolved into an aquatic animal. That is not an easy engineering challenge, of course.
No, it's a major challenge for evolutionists.
How would you go about trying to communicate to the audience? Of course, the body size changes tremendously when you get up to the larger whales. The blue whales could be 100 feet long and could weigh 150 tons. And of course, the story begins with the tiniest little creatures. You show the size of their actual body sizes in comparison, where the evolutionists tend to only show their skeleton. And they ignore the size. Some of these, when you compare it to a whale, some of these things look like a period at the end of a sentence.
They do, yeah.
Yeah, but the evolutionists don't tell you that. They show you a skeleton and they say, look, this skeleton looks sort of like the whale skeleton. They leave out quantifying the difference in size, which is such a great point that you make.
The Miller text in front of me, you see the same problem, that supposed earliest evolutionary ancestors of whale look not as large as a whale, but probably an eighth or ninth as large as a whale, which is way different from the actual scale.
Yeah, the actual scale. If you took a picture of a whale and you put it on a typical book's page, and then lower in the page you put a little dot, like an exclamation point and a dot, the dot is about the size in ratio to your whale. And that's just an example of deception, I think.
Good example.
Well, then, how about the challenges, though, to go from, it seems absurd to think that if you're going to engineer, let's say you want to build a submarine, and you were going to start with a bus, like a Greyhound bus, that would be way more difficult than just building a submarine to start from. Or if you wanted to build an airplane, and you say, we're going to start with a Honda Accord, with an automobile, it's way more difficult, the engineering challenge, to turn one thing into another than just to build the other thing quite often. And so they want to take land animals and change them into aquatic animals. And there are so many things that have to change simultaneously. Could you give us an idea of some of the systems in a land-dwelling animal that have to change?
Well, among other things is the method they use to obtain oxygen. Of course, a whale obtains oxygen from the air, as mammals do, because whales are mammals. Fish obtain oxygen via gills. It's quite a gap to go from breathing on land to breathing in the water, because whales have to spend most of their time in the water, so therefore they have to take in enough oxygen to be able to roam around in the sea for about, an hour, sometimes as long as 2 hours. So
wow,
that's quite a feat. How many people can stay underwater for 2 hours?
And so they have a blowhole on the top of their skull. So a land creature would have something like nostrils in the front of its face. So first you had fish with gills. Then those gills evolved into lungs, which is an extraordinary challenge. Forget about the birds, because they breathe completely differently. The lungs would have to rupture to begin to create bird respiration. But then the mammal starts to, I guess he starts to play in the surf on the beach. And he does this for how many thousands or millions of years before his nostril begins to move to the top of his head? And he could take in air and hold it for an hour. These engineering challenges are so extreme, but they're met with the silliest, superficial kind of storytelling from, as you stated, 2012, the most advanced evolution textbooks.
But again, they believe evolution occurred, and so therefore it's not a question of how it occurred. They've got to figure out the details to demonstrate the fact that it occurred. And they admit that's a problem, but they say, well, give us time. We've only been working on this for a couple hundred years, so give us another couple hundred more, and we'll figure out how it was done.
The hearing and eyesight, for example, those things have had to change. I imagine you are aware of the recent study by geneticists who they compared the echolocation gene in a whale and in a bat. So these are two creatures that are pretty far apart on Darwin's alleged tree of life, and they found that there is an identical sequence in this echolocation gene, which absolutely stunned them, because there is no common ancestor between a whale and a bat that has an echolocating gene, and yet here they are identical. So could you explain to us what would the difference be in the creationist explanation of that and the challenge then for the Darwinist?
Well, creationists would say that an echolocation system has to have a number of elements in common to work. It's a system which sends out sound waves. They bounce back and they come back to the animal, and the animal picks it up, then can interpret how far the object that they bounced away from was. For that to work, for any echolocation system, you must have a sender, a receiver, and some way of analyzing how far away the object was and the shape and so on before you can figure out how it works. But once you figure out how it works, then, of course, you realize you have common parts.
And so a creator, a common designer, you would expect to see common features, common genetic tools used in anything from a sponge to a banana to a kangaroo. You'd expect some commonality of design. When you come to evolution, in order to program or to write some code, I used to study computer science at Arizona State University. I worked in the simulation department for McDonnell Douglas Helicopter Company on the Apache attack helicopter for the Army. And so I'm familiar with programming code. And when you have some sophisticated chunk of code, there's got to be billions of possible ways to program that code. And here, the evolutionists now are pressed into believing something they would never predict. They'd predict the opposite, that the whale and the bat, through random mutation and natural selection, they evolve. They call it convergence, an identical genetic sequence, identical. That seems to be strong evidence that falsifies their claim that genetic sequences evolve by random mutation.
And this is only one of many, many, many examples. The most famous example is the eye, which they assume is involved separately, but yet we have pretty much identical eyes, the retina type eye, 37 different times is one estimate. Some estimate more times, some less, but nonetheless, how do we get, as you said, an almost identical structure that evolved totally separately from other eyes that evolved, and yet we have the end result is pretty much the same. In fact, some cases it's close to identical.
You have a quote from a standard work, Evolution of Vertebrates, 5th edition, in 2001, Colbert, who concludes, quote, "Whales appear suddenly, fully adapted for a highly specialized mode of life. This seems to be true of turtles," and on and on and on. If you look at flowering plants, you look at birds, and they appear in ways that Carl Linnaeus would be happy to go to work trying to classify them. And the fossil record, instead of showing gradual changes, it seems to show sudden appearance and then stasis. The organisms stay the same throughout the fossil record.
And that's true over and over. Even in the Miller book, the last step in the evolution of a whale, of course, looks like a whale, and that's what we find in the fossil record. Whales look like whales. Even though we find fossils that evolutionist date is many, many millions of years old, yet they still look like modern whales.
Dr. Bergman, a few months ago, I debated on this show, lengthy debate, a professor of ophthalmology from the University of California, and he made a claim on the show that I wish I had read some of your material a little more carefully. I've read a lot of what you've written, but you're an expert on rebutting the claim of vestigial organs. He made a claim, and this is his area of expertise, that in the eye, the human eye, there's a nictitating membrane and the plica semilunaris. I wasn't familiar with these terms. And he said they have absolutely no function. So what I found out later after the show is that he's basically quoting Darwin, an evolutionist from the 1860s. And so I looked up the latest in Duane's Ophthalmology, clinical source for the latest information, and it said that the plica semilunaris has two important functions. One, it helps drain your tears, otherwise they'd run out on your cheek. And two, it gives greater rotation to the orb, to your eyeball, because otherwise your eyes wouldn't be able to move right and left, up and down as freely as they do. So here's an ophthalmologist professor at the University of California saying that they have no function, and he's about 150 years out of date. And here's a pastor, radio talk show host, creationist, who's willing to look at the latest science.
That's quite amazing. I have a section on that in my book on vestigial organs, and it's been known at least since the 30s, that's the earliest reference I found, that the plica semilunaris does indeed have a very important function. It's not a nictitating membrane, as they claim. Quite different. It's a different structure. And they, of course, incorrectly label it a nictitating membrane. And you're right. It does indeed have these two and other functions. It's quite important. And that's clear in the books that I consulted as well as the book that you consulted.
What I'd like to do then is to link from that show summary of that debate to your book, which we have referenced in the past. The title of your book is on vestigial.
Vestigial organs are fully functional.
That is just great. And of course, the evolutionists, it's a moving target. They used to say these are organs and glands that have no function. They're left over from evolution. And then thousands of functions were attributed to all these alleged functionless entities. They said, well, they lost some of their function. The way they presented, it's non-falsifiable. They just keep changing the story as more and more science and data comes to the surface.
Right. And that also, that new definition is somewhat meaningless because we have less effective smell than dogs. So therefore, is our smell system vestigial? We have less effective seeing than many birds. So therefore,
is our
eyes vestigial? When you use that definition, it becomes almost meaningless because you can always find an animal that has a more superior sensory system or other system than we have, except possibly the brain. That's probably the only exception, that other animals don't have a smarter brain. They've got better facilities.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, so the one organ that they can't show has degraded, the only one is the one that creationists know has degraded, because God created Adam and Eve with this ability, this intellect, that we have since lost. We've not been evolving. We've been devolving. And because of genetic deterioration and all, we don't have the intellectual abilities that the ancients had 6,000 years ago. So it's the funniest thing. So often, evolutionists get things exactly backwards.
That's a good point. And if you study ancient languages, you can see how that is very, very true. What you mentioned relative to, we have less intellectual functions in some ways than the ancients.
And Dr. Bergman, we've been pointing that out. When you read ancient texts, you immediately recognize how brilliant the ancient readers were, because we're like dumbed down to a fourth grade level. You read a modern magazine, they're all short sentences, you know. They had the ability to grasp multiple nesting of complex concepts in a single sentence. And they would memorize these things because they didn't have printing presses, and they would memorize huge swaths of literature. Today, we'd be amazed by one person doing that, and it seemed to be somewhat cultural back then. Could you tell us about the claim from evolutionists that hip bones in whales are vestigial, they have no function, and therefore that's proof that whales evolved from land creatures that use their hip bones to attach to legs and so on?
Yeah, the hip bones have structures from them, but those are very important copulatory organs. Imagine trying to mate as a whale when you weigh, you know, 50 tons underwater. It's not very easy. And so copulatory organs is what it's widely acknowledged that these are. They're not vestigial feet. They're simply very important structures which facilitate mating for many types of whales.
And what you do is you, and this is typical of your work, I so appreciate it, Dr. Berkman, you quote from the leading authorities who are evolutionists. It seems to me that creationists quote most often from evolutionists and occasionally from other creationists. You show that these important functions have been identified, and you compare it, for example, to a bone in the human neck. You could see this bone that's sort of floating in your skeleton. Well, it's important because there are muscles that attach to it. These so-called pelvic bones in whales, they have essential function, and you describe that function. They typically tend to involve the male reproduction, and that they're different between the male and the female in these whale species. But the evolutionist will find something that they don't understand, its function. They'll say, look, that's proof of evolution. It's a vestigial bone. When the evidence of its function comes out, they're the ones in denial, and they stick to their story and they deny the science.
Well, they don't like information that they themselves found and propagated used against them. It's a we-they contrast that we see commonly among many Darwinists.
I think that we only have a few more minutes, maybe time for one other issue. Tooth buds. This has been a story for some years. Baleen whales, as you described earlier, they're different from the toothed whales. They gulp enormous quantity of seawater, and then they sort of filter that water, so the water gets expelled, and the krill remain. They could ingest, what, hundreds of pounds of krill in a single gulp. But they have tooth buds that develop, but they don't end up with teeth.
Well, the tooth buds provide a framework for the development of the mouth area. You have every part of the body has to have a framework, some type of either cartilage or bone framework. Usually cartilage first, then bone may develop in many animals. So the framework is important in the development of the systems. It's in a very effective and economical way of producing the end result that we see.
Once again, you quote from many authorities, anatomists, and people who have traced the development of jaws. This is going back almost 100 years, where they will publish in the Transactions of the Royal Society of Canada, if teeth do not eventually develop, then the jaw is deformed. And so
right,
there are purposes in the engineering of a living organism that are fetal, embryonic in nature, where in order to end up with the adult, you have to do amazing things as you're building that adult. So the evolutionists ignore those engineering requirements and that complexity, and they'll see something and they'll say, Ernst Haeckel, in his fraudulent drawings of the human embryo, he drew bogus drawings of different species, and he put gill slits in the human embryo, which was fabricated. Babies in the womb, they never have gills. They don't breathe through gill slits in the womb. They're too big to fail. So even though this has all been identified, even by evolutionists, that's not true. Even on Wikipedia, you'll still find it in textbooks in high school.
All right. You have to distinguish between evolutionists who are trying to prove a theory and anatomists who are not trying to prove anything. They're just trying to understand how the body works. And I've used 4 or 5 different anatomy books in teaching at the college here, and none of them mention vestigial organs. None of them have these claims. In fact, none of them even talk about evolution. They just simply present the facts, and therefore There's a lot of scientists that come up with this information, but evolutionists often refuse to listen to their own colleagues who are scientists as well, recognized scientists,
who are the anatomists,
point out these problems.
Right, the specialists. The way Richard Dawkins ignores the anatomists to explain the wiring of the human eye is optimal. He has this embarrassing decades-old argument that it's wired backwards when it's actually optimal. You point out
right.
that evolutionists, believing that the baleen whales once had teeth that became vestigial, they went looking in their DNA for the genes that make enamel, because teeth have enamel. And if the teeth no longer are produced, they should be able to find the enamel genes. Did they ever find those genes?
As far as I know, they haven't.
That's exactly right. So, well, thank you, Dr. Bergman. It's an honor to have you on. And we look forward to having you on again soon to talk about your book about the Nazi eugenic crusade.
Thank you for having me on.
That is Dr. Jerry Bergman, who has authored now over 900 publications. We're talking peer-reviewed journal articles and books and monographs, an extraordinary life's work, and that in the service of getting at the truth that Darwinian evolution is a lie. And the truth is that God created us. Our website is Real Science Radio, realscienceradio.com. Go to our website, click on the store, and get the DVDs from Dr. Carl Werner. You'll love it. Dr. Carl Werner on living fossils. May God bless you.
Explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.
Hi, this is Bob Enyart. At Real Science Radio, we have a great science store. Online, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store, and there are two fabulous DVDs, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy, Volume 1 and Volume 2. These are by a dear friend of Real Science Radio, Spike Pisaris, and Spike has created simply the greatest astronomy DVDs ever produced. We have gone through probably hundreds of science DVDs and books, and we recommend only the very best at our store, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store, and you'll love these astronomy DVDs, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy, Volume 1 and Volume 2. Click on the store. RealScienceRadio.com. You got to get them.